Good morning. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell. I'm in for Joy Cardine today. Joy, by the way, will be back on Monday. Well, it's 8 o'clock on Friday. It's time for the Week in Review, and we're going to be taking a look back at some of the top stories that have been making the news around the world, around the country, and around the state this week. We'll be inviting your comments, and so we'll be starting out in the international realm, moving into national and then states. So keep that in mind when you want to make a call. Here's a phone number for you to keep in mind as well, 800-642-1234. That is the toll-free number that you can use to be part of the conversation. And in Madison, it is 263-1890. If you'd like to join us by email, you can do that too. That address is talk@wpr.org. We're joined in the studio this morning by Ed Garvey, a senior partner with the law firm of Garvey, McNeil, and McGillivray, a former Democratic gubernatorial candidate here in Wisconsin, and the editor and publisher of FightingBob.com. And good morning, Ed Garvey.
Hey, good morning, Gene.
We're also joined on the phone this morning by Owen Robinson, a conservative blogger with BootsandSabers.com. And he is also a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. And good morning, Owen Robinson.
Good morning, Gene, and good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Owen.
Good morning to both of you. Glad to have both of you along. We're going to start out in the international realm this morning, and I'm going to play a cut here from President Bush that I think we heard earlier this week.
It can be tempting to look at the challenges in Iraq and conclude our best option is to pack up and go home. That may be satisfying in the short run, but I believe the consequences for American security would be devastating. If American forces were to step back from Baghdad before it is more secure, a contagion of violence could spill out across the entire country. In time, this violence could engulf the region. The terrorists could emerge from the chaos with a safe haven in Iraq to replace the one they had in Afghanistan, which they used to plan the attacks of September the 11th, 2001. For the safety of the American people, we cannot allow this to happen.
And there we hear from President Bush earlier this week making the case for Iraq as the war has entered its fifth year now, as we celebrated, not celebrate, that's the wrong term. It was the fourth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. And Ed Garvey, let's start with you, your reaction.
Well, you know, it's there's really you almost don't know where to start. I mean, we got into this war. It reminds me of what tangled webs we weave when we start out to deceive. It's been a fiasco. We've lost it. We've created more terrorists. And now we have the president saying, just give us some more time, some more troops, some more deaths, some more refugees, and maybe something good will come of it. So I'm hopeful that the Democrats will tie the withdrawal from Iraq to the appropriations bill. We're going broke. Just about everybody says there's no way that we can win this battle. And the president continues to use science fiction writers to try to scare the American people and use fear to say you've got to continue to do what we've been doing, which is to lose.
Owen Robinson.
Well, I think we're not hearing anything new from President Bush here, and I think he's still right.
Far right.
What he, I'd argue against that, but the truth is that we are in Iraq, and there will be consequences if we pull out, and we have to weigh those consequences against the benefits of pulling out. And I have to admit, I kind of chuckled at the comment that we're going broke because the appropriations bill that the Democrats just put up in the House has $21 billion in pork on top of the spending. If we're going broke, then it's certainly not just because of this war.
And let's talk about the congressional aspect of things. There's a couple of votes going on right now. That money you speak of, Owen Robinson, has been a subject of great debate. What is happening in Congress right now? What is your estimation of things? And let's start with Owen Robinson.
Well, it looks to me that the as of this morning, the House leadership has gotten the liberal group to the liberal caucus to back down, and they'll vote for the leadership's bill. It'll go to the Senate, has approval in Senate committee. My guess is that the bill won't make it through the Senate with the timetable to withdraw. If it does, it goes to a certain presidential veto, and there certainly aren't the votes to override that veto. So really, at this point, it's about posturing and trying to appease the base. It's nothing that will ever make it into actual law.
You know, we're talking about roughly 100,000 refugees per month leaving Iraq. We're talking about a country that's been almost destroyed. It's not been rebuilt at all as a result of our terrible actions in the privatization, really, of reconstruction in Iraq. The costs now are estimated at $2 trillion for this war. There's been no sacrifice asked of the American people in terms of taxes or a draft or anything else. And so what we're talking about when Owen says we'll continue, we're talking about the deaths of hundreds more U.S. soldiers, thousands more Iraqi civilians, and an increased probability that al-Qaeda and others will benefit from what we're doing there. So I don't think it's posturing. I think that the Democrats have to pull together and stop this funding and get the troops home, because that's what the American people want.
Owen Robinson, anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I would just point out that all wars have costs. All wars lose lives. We don't gauge the value of a war based on the cost necessarily all the time. For instance, World War II, Korean War, we lost tens of thousands of lives and spent billions of dollars. And most people would say that what we did in World War II was both a just war and a necessary war. So whether or not, you know, Ed is of course right. We're talking about extending a war. We're talking about losing lives. But we also have to take into account if we pull out the lives that will be lost. All the Iraqis who stood up for their freedom will be massacred by the other people. We see Iran this morning captured 15 British sailors in Iraqi waters. Iran has a hard currency issue where they're having trouble keeping up with their nuclear program. They want Iraq to fall so they can go in there and get some money out of it to keep their nuclear program going. There will be consequences if we pull out, and I think it's just somewhat cavalier to discount those and say, oh, but that's okay because at least it's not American money, at least it's not American lives. I thought liberals were concerned about humanity, not just America.
Well, you know, let me be one of those liberals who says I'm also worried about the status of our armed forces. And when you get the leadership of our armed forces saying that the army is nearly broken because we're so overextended, they don't have the equipment, they don't have the troops, they don't have the recruits, we could not take on another battle if we had to. You know, what has been so catastrophic about this is not only have we lost the support of the rest of the world, but we have crippled our army so that we could not respond to an emergency if we had to do it quickly. So I thought conservatives were concerned about national security, but apparently they're not.
And I agree with Ed. We should engage in a good, robust military buildup.
Let's take a call right now from Dave, who joins us from Birchwood. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Regarding the Iraq war, although we can all agree that certainly this has not been done the way it should have been done, if it was going to be done at all, that issue has pretty much been decided. The question now is, what do we go from here? I believe that the liberal base of the Democratic Party, which is asking for a pullout, is living in some sort of fantasy land that thinks that if we just leave like we left in Vietnam, that 20 or 30 years from now, all of the Iraqis will be good little boys and girls like the Vietnamese are now, forgetting, of course, that there were literally millions of people in Southeast Asia who died after our pullout because of the fact that we no longer supported democracy there. The situation is going to be much, much worse in the Middle East if we pull out too soon now. I believe, ultimately, we're facing a wider war with the Islamic radicals, and our only chance really to avoid that and the resultant many, many casualties that would come on both sides from that war would be to stay the course that we're doing right now. There's no guarantee that it's going to work, and we certainly have to keep an eye on things very closely because we haven't handled things the best way we have up till now.
But not only is there no guarantee, there's no indication that things are getting better. I mean, the premise of your argument is that somehow things are improving, and therefore if we stay long enough, things will get better. Here we have the poll that shows that about 80% of the Iraqis want us to leave. They're engaged in a civil war. Think about our own civil war. What would we have thought if the French had been in there, supplying the South with armaments? So, I mean, you know, frankly, if things were getting better, you wouldn't be in quite the situation you're in right now. But the thought that we're going to be responsible, how about the responsibility for over a million civilians dead as a result of the study from Australia that just came out the other day, or the hundreds of thousands of refugees who are now, their lives have essentially been ruined, or the hundreds of American soldiers who have been killed. I mean, it's as if this is, somehow a board game that people don't find to be engaging. That's why I guess, you know, I started out a long time ago saying I think we should have a draft without any diversions or any excuses for not serving. And we could just take the list that Dick Cheney used for Vietnam as kind of our guide. Because if this is not a joint sacrifice or a shared sacrifice by the American people, then the armchair quarterbacks can say, well, send in more troops, and if they get killed, well, that's too bad.
Let's give Owen Robinson the last word.
Well, I think Ed is right, and to the extent that, again, all wars have costs, all battles that we engage in have costs both in lives, both in money, in a number of arenas. The question is whether that cost is worth what we receive at the end. And there are many people, including our caller here, who believe what I believe, that part of what we're doing here is taking the fight to the enemy. We're cleaning out safe harbors for terrorists and making sure that we don't allow them to have safe haven, that they're constantly harassed, that we cut off their money supplies, that we cut off places where they can put up training camps, that's what we're out trying to do. And that, you know, and we talk about polls. There's also a poll from Iraqis saying that they believe their lives are much better now than they were under Saddam. And I guess we really come down to a very different philosophy here, in that there are some of us who support this war and support the actions in Afghanistan and other places because it's going out and taking the fight to the enemy rather than sitting back and waiting to respond to the next terrorist attack.
Well, let's just hope. At least this morning I woke up and we have not bombed Iran yet.
Okay, well, we'll be back in just a second. We've got to take a break, and we'll return with our Week in Review. Owen Robinson is with us, a conservative blogger with bootsandsabers.com and a columnist for the West Bend Daily News. Ed Garvey joins us as well, editor and publisher of fightingbob.com, among other things. We'll be returning right after this break here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 22 minutes past 8 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine this week. Joy will be back on Monday. Elizabeth Edwards announced yesterday that her cancer has returned and spread to her bones now. After 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guests discussed the physical and emotional impact of breast cancer. That's up after 9 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it is the Week in Review with Ed Garvey and Owen Robinson, and we are going down the list of events that have happened in the past week. We're going to turn to what's happening on the national scene right now, and I have another piece of tape here, and again, we feature President Bush.
We will not go along with a partisan fishing expedition aimed at honorable public servants. Initial response by Democrats unfortunately shows some appear more interested in scoring political points than in learning the facts. It will be regrettable if they choose to head down the partisan road of issuing subpoenas and demanding show trials.
And there you have President Bush, who has been talking about a situation that has been developing from the firing of U.S. attorneys a couple of months ago. It is now turning into a full-fledged front-page topic almost every day. I want to take this slightly out of order and go to a listener first who wants to talk about this. Linda from Monroe joins us. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Now, this shouldn't necessarily be a Republican or Democratic issue, but when one testifies in front of Congress, it should be under oath. As far as I know, everybody that goes to court has to testify under oath, so why shouldn't Attorney General Gonzalez or even Karl Rove have to do the same thing? And if not, then they should have a special prosecutor to investigate this issue of the firing of the U.S. attorneys.
Linda, thanks for the call. Let's start with Owen Robinson.
Well, the truth is that there is a clear distinction in the law regarding the separation of powers, and the administration and the executive branch does have a right to keep their people from being investigated in that manner. And it's actually pretty clear in the law. If Bush goes to court on this, it's pretty much an open shut case. But what's pretty clear here is this is an entirely phony scandal. You have the Attorney General firing a few U.S. attorneys in the U.S. because he believed they were not sufficiently prosecuting voter fraud cases, which is a legitimate reason. But honestly, he doesn't even need that reason. These are political appointees. They can be let go at any time. They serve at the pleasure of the president. And if the president wants to let them go because he looked at him the wrong way, that's within his power and within his right. And especially when you consider the hypocrisy of the fact that Clinton came into office and released every single U.S. attorney, all 93 of them, in one batch to clean house, which is something Bush did not do. So when you look back at this, it's an entirely manufactured scandal, and it's about time that Bush got around to realizing that this is going to be the Democrats' mantra for the next year and a half, 2 years, is to, you know, go after these phony scandals, trump up, and try to get scalps. They got the UN ambassador's scalp. Now they're going after. They got Rumsfeld's scalp. Now they're going after Gonzalez's scalp, and they're going to keep going until the administration finds its spine and decides to exercise its constitutional responsibilities and rights.
Ed Garvey.
I hope I'm never as inconsistent as Owen in my life on a major issue as he is on this one. When Clinton is president, they supported all kinds of subpoenas and oversight, as the Congress has a right to oversight. What we should talk about this program should be the Bush outrage of the week rather than the week in review. What Alberto Gonzalez and Karl Rove and Bush and Cheney were trying to do was to throw the fear of God into all the U.S. attorneys to be better Bushies, as they say, and in so doing have, you know, sullied the reputation of every U.S. attorney who wasn't on that list. So they talked about firing all of them so that they could cover the tracks on the 8 to 10 that they thought were not sufficiently pro-Bush, which, you know, questions the integrity of our U.S. attorneys, which I don't think is very healthy, to say the least. As for Alberto Gonzalez, if he doesn't resign, I think he should be the first impeached official of this administration. He's the one who wrote the memo about torture, saying that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply. He's the one who says he didn't know what his deputy was doing when he was talking about firing all 93 of the U.S. attorneys. And now he's lying his way out by saying he was unaware of what was going on. So it's not a manufactured crisis. This is a crisis of confidence in our entire process of justice. If we have to question whether Steve Biskupic is doing what he's doing because he's being a good, loyal Bushy or not, it hurts him, it hurts the system, it hurts everybody who practices within the judicial process.
I want to follow up on this a bit. I heard a couple of stories about some analysis on the way in this morning. And one piece of analysis speculated that most members of the public are not particularly concerned about this, that this is a story that is more inside politics, that reporters who cover the White House find it interesting. People who are in the White House find it interesting. People who would like to be in the White House find it interesting. But that the public at large has other interests. And Ed Garvey, I'm wondering about your response to that.
Well, I'm sure it's, for example, like that poll that was released that something like 90% of the people of Wisconsin could not name a Supreme Court justice. The fact is that there is a certain confidence level that people have in government, that they assume that things like this don't happen, that you don't have a litmus test for all the U.S. attorneys as to how they're proceeding. They will care about it when Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez are held in contempt of Congress for refusing these subpoenas. And I do think the Supreme Court, as biased as it has become under the Republican appointments, will say that they have to testify under oath so that the American people can find out. So they may not know about it today, but they will within the next few weeks. And they're going to be furious because we have to have some confidence in the attorneys general and in the U.S. attorneys. If we don't, our system of government collapses.
Owen Robinson.
Well, let me summarize that. In other words, the Democrats are going to hammer on this until the people care. The truth is people don't care because they look at it and say, oh, the U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president, and he fired 10% of them 6 years into his term, you know, into his presidency. Who cares? That's his right. And as far as congressional oversight, yes, Congress has a duty and a responsibility of oversight of the executive branch, but there is no evidence of any criminal activity here or unethical behavior. What this is they want to bring a line of administration officials before committees and have C-SPAN and CNN there cover it and get their faces on the news and make show trials. And we should have more respect for the law than to sit back and have show trials to try and disparage the reputations of administration officials.
Well, let me ask you a question. How do you defend Pete Domenici, the senator, calling the U.S. attorney to ask how he's coming with the prosecution of a Democrat?
I don't. I don't make it my business to defend politicians.
Sorry, would you condemn it?
Would I condemn it? Calling to check on it? Again, you talk about congressional oversight. You have a congressman calling a U.S. attorney to check on the status of a case.
He can call the attorney general.
As long as he wasn't encouraging the U.S. attorney to move in a certain path to prosecute a certain way, then I see nothing wrong with it whatsoever with a congressman looking to get more information on how a case is progressing. I would hope that all of us could call the U.S. attorney, including the media, and say, how is this case going?
Yeah,
where is it going?
Speaking of calls, we have a call from Milwaukee. Jenna would like to join in. Hi, Jenna.
Hi. I actually just want to say, whether you want to say that this is made-up mock trial or not, I think it really goes to show that finally the American people and those that represent us are wanting the Bush administration and people in there to answer some questions that we have so that we can really see if they are telling us the truth and really see if we do, when it comes to our troops or when it comes to our taxes, if we really do want to do what this Bush administration says. I personally, and I know plenty of people that are sick of the lies, that are sick of the fear, and I think that there's no reason to say that it's Congress is not doing a good job at asking the Bush administration questions. We are allowed to ask questions, and if it means that it needs to be in court, it means that it needs to be in court. That's my comment.
All right, Jenna, thanks for the call. Let's start with Owen.
I was going to say, I think Jenna illustrates exactly what's going on here, and that there is a general distrust, hatred of the Bush administration by the left in this country, and what they want is to again, bring officials up and question them about whatever they want for any length of time, forever, to embarrass the administration. Here we're talking about a very specific issue, the firing of U.S. attorneys. The administration has released the documentation to Congress. Congress has vetted it. What they haven't had the opportunity yet is question officials, but there's been the opportunity to do so. Again, it ultimately comes down to the president could have fired those U.S. attorneys for any reason he chose.
But they don't
any
do that, Owen.
Whatsoever.
Come on,
and
they don't do that.
There is no illegal activity here. There is no unethical activity here. There may be political points to be scored, but there is certainly no activity here that is the business
Owen,
of Congress.
It's never happened before. Never have they even thought about firing this many U.S.
Like
attorneys.
Like firing 93 attorneys at the beginning of your administration?
No, come on. At the end of your administration... Come on, you know very well that when a new administration comes in, then the U.S. attorneys change.
No president before Clinton had ever fired the entire U.S. attorney staff. That was unprecedented. It had never happened.
It happens almost to a certainty, with maybe a couple of exceptions, but for the most part, a new president comes in and he appoints or she appoints the new U.S. attorneys. But no one has ever had 8 or 9 or 10 U.S. attorneys in midstream brought up for firing. And then when they get caught, they say, it was for competence. And those U.S. attorneys are now fighting back. If they don't have anything to hide, then bring Karl Rove and Alberto Gonzalez before the Congress and let the American people hear their explanations.
Frankly, I find it refreshing that we have an administration who's willing to fire officials who weren't doing the job they were tasked to be doing.
Oh, okay, let this one go. If people would like to look up the process, by the way, there's lots of information out there on what presidents can and can't do and what's been done in the past. Lots of history written down. Let's go back to Capitol Hill right now and listen to this piece of tape from former Vice President Al Gore.
The planet has a fever. If your baby has a fever, you go to the doctor. If the doctor says you need to intervene here, you don't say, well, I read a science fiction novel that tells me it's not a problem.
All right, there's former Vice President Al Gore back on Capitol Hill and talking about global warming in the wake of his movie, An Inconvenient Truth. He is now an Oscar winner, I guess, and he was treated a little differently this time around. Ed Garvey, what do you think about his return to Capitol Hill? And follow up on that with, there's still a lot of people looking at him and saying, are you going to run for president? And he keeps saying no.
Well, I think he has performed a tremendous service to the American people with his movie that I think has brought global warming to the attention of the American people in a way that nothing has in the past. He's even forced the Bush administration to admit that maybe the globe is warming a bit, even though they continue to censor the NASA records and other records. So I would like to see Al Gore run. I think he is a refreshing voice. I think he's right on the subject of a major issue. And I think, frankly, we have some very good candidates who are running, but I think Al Gore would add to the debate, so I wouldn't count him out. And I was delighted with his testimony because it's forcing the Congress to deal with this issue as well.
Owen Robinson.
I agree with Ed. I would love for Al Gore to run because I think You know, I think
his, okay, he shouldn't.
His coming into this hearing was a perfect example of why he would absolutely fall on his face in a presidential run. He tried to set up special rules for himself where he wouldn't be quizzed in certain ways, where he'd be protected from criticism. You know, you can't run for the president and for the presidency and expect not to be criticized, not to be challenged, not to be confronted.
Sort of like Karl Rove.
And I think he would be a breath of fresh air in the Democratic primary.
All right, I've got another piece of tape here. I'm going to bring it up in the background and see if you guys are politically astute enough to recognize this piece of audio.
I'm looking
you hear
at
the
how
marching,
to help you
hear the voices.
And other people who are hardworking like you. And I've really been impressed by how serious people are.
And what you can't see on the radio, of course, is the woman running down the aisle there with the hammer and swinging it into the screen of Hillary Clinton and having it shatter. And Owen Robinson, let's start with you. The ad broke on YouTube this week. We found out who did it. But I'm more interested in the impact that this type of advertising is having on people who are following politics and, you know, whether it's bringing more people in, I guess, to what it's certainly taking some control away from candidates who like to control their message, and this adds a whole other element to things.
Absolutely, and I think it's a fascinating topic on a several different fronts. First, it's interesting to see the effect of the internet and new media. Ed Garvey with his blog, of course, and me with mine, and such are having an effect on politics that hasn't been felt, and it's really the people being able to speak out. It ends up this ad, which was a redux of the Apple 1984 ad shown during the Super Bowl back then, with Hillary representing the establishment, representing Big Brother, being shattered and encouraging a vote for Obama. It turns out it was produced by some low-level Obama, consulting firm that was working for Obama, but he did it on his own time, and it shows just how one person sitting at their computer with a little bit of software and too much time on their hands can really start affecting the political debate. And that video has been seen by over 1.5 million people, which is quite a better reach than a good number of ads that go out. I think it's also going to be interesting to see what happens with campaign finance reform. Or campaign finance laws, as far as how that's controlled, how that's regulated, if it will be controlled, and if it will be regulated. It's getting to the point with technology that the pretense that we can go out and regulate and document every single person who has an influence on a political campaign is kind of becoming a ridiculous concept. And also for the campaigns themselves, you know, campaigns love to have very, very tight message control, and I think that there is not going to be a campaign ever again that has the kind of message control that we saw in the past several years.
I'm a little more suspicious of this. I think what's happening here is that campaign operatives are doing things that will plant ideas in people's minds. When Ann Coulter says that, and people stayed on the stage and clapped and hooted and applauded when she said that John Edwards was a faggot. Now, I mean, for heaven's sake, what is she trying to do there except to plant in people's minds something about John Edwards? I'm a little suspicious of this Hillary Clinton commercial. It could be somebody from Hillary Clinton's campaign trying to, you know, do it from a reverse point of view. It could be somebody from Obama's campaign. It could be Boots and Sabres, for all I know.
No, they've already figured out who it was.
I thought that was your theme song. Yeah, but who knows who they really are? I mean, the fact is that I think we are in a very dangerous moment in terms of how we identify our candidates and what is said. But let's take Ann Coulter just for a second. What surprised me is that after she made her comments, Mitt Romney and Cheney and others stayed right there in the audience. I would have jumped up, as I'm sure that Owen would have, and walked off the stage in protest of her making such an outrageous comment. But this is the kind of negative campaigning that I think does have to be examined. And, you know, if they intentionally set out to destroy someone's character, we do have libel laws in this country to try to protect us.
Well, and Ed's right. We do have libel laws to protect us. I don't know that this ad was directed specifically at destroying someone's character. I think it was a political statement. I'm not speaking of Coulter. I'm speaking of the Obama ad. It's speaking to Clinton being part of the establishment and Obama being a fresh face. I think it's a clear political point and not related to personality.
But who would do that on his own?
But I do find it interesting how Ed finds individual political free speech to be dangerous, where, as I see it, is again, it's enlightening. It's fresh air. It's nice to see people have an avenue to be able to affect the politics in their country,
even
without
under
needing a lot of money, without needing a lot of expertise, of being able to just have a voice.
You've come full circle.
Regarding Coulter, I would say that I, on Boots and Sabres, was aggressively denouncing Coulter, along with a number of other conservatives who are seeking to purge her.
Why didn't Mitt Romney walk off that stage?
Romney is not a conservative, first of all.
Well, but why didn't he walk off that stage? Why did people applaud?
He brought in socialized medicine. He promotes gay marriage. I mean, he's clearly not a conservative. He's trying to portray one as now, and he doesn't have the support of the conservative base. So I don't see how you can claim he represents conservatives. He's more of a your typical egocentric presidential hack who's going to say and do whatever he thinks is necessary to be president.
So you're not supporting him.
Gee, where'd you get that idea?
All right, we've got to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to return to presidential politics, and we'll continue our discussion here on The Week in Review. Ed Garvey is with us, as well as Owen Robinson, and we are talking about some of the events that we've been hearing about for the past 7 days. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine this morning, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 19 minutes before 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Joy Cardine for the rest of the day. Joy will be back on Monday. It is the Week in Review, and we are talking with Ed Garvey and Owen Robinson about events that have shaped the news in the last week. And I have another piece of tape here that I'm going to be playing, this time from a former Wisconsin Governor, Tommy Thompson. And he is being interviewed here, and he is talking about his plan for Iraq if he were elected president.
Well, I think I've got ideas. First off, I think the Iraq war is one in which we need to make some severe changes, and I believe I'm the one that has a plan that is going to help rebuild Iraq. Number one, I would require the Iraq al-Malkiya government to vote as to whether or not they want the United States in the country. You know, nobody's ever asked the al-Maliki government. They're duly elected, and they should be required to vote as to whether or not they want it. Secondly, there are 18 territories in Iraq, and we should allow those territories to elect their own leaders, just like we elect state leaders all across America. Number three, I think we should allow, just like we do in Alaska, divide up the oil revenue and the gas revenues for all the people, one-third for the central government, one-third for the territories, and one-third for every man, woman, and child.
And there we have former Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson talking about what he would do if he were elected president. Polls, however, show him near the back of a crowded field of Republicans, but Tommy Thompson says he's been a dark horse before. He said he was the dark horse candidate for governor in Wisconsin and a dark horse when he ran for the assembly, and it's a position he's comfortable on. He is banking a lot, though, on what's going to happen in Iowa. And Ed Garvey, let's start with you on this.
Well, I like Tommy as a person. I ran against him. He was always a decent
individual. That's right.
Individual.
I forgot about that. You did. Okay.
Well, most people have. I think he won. But I think he has absolutely no chance whatsoever. I do like the idea of splitting up the oil revenues for the people of Iraq as opposed to BP, Amoco, and the Mobil. And that's why I think we're still in Iraq, is to protect the privatization of the oil fields for the big oil companies. But Tommy is just too liberal for Owen or for the hard right that controls the Republican Party. And I think he has zero chance in Iowa or any other place.
Owen Robinson.
Well, Ed is exactly right. He is too liberal, and he will not win the nomination. And I sense that this is more of a campaign to puff up Tommy's ego than it is to actually accomplish anything. I don't think he'll accept a vice presidential bid if it were offered to him. And, you know, even this week he accepted yet another position on a corporate board. And I think he's in a position where he's making a whole lot of money, and I don't see him giving that up for anything less than the presidency, and I don't think he has a shot at it. As for his plan for Iraq, it's kind of comical, actually. You know, as far as asking the Iraqis if we should be there, you know, of course their opinion is important, but it depends on why you think we're there. Are we there for our national security, or are we there as a guest of the Iraqi government? If we're there for our national security, then it doesn't really matter what the Iraqi government thinks. And his other ideas as far as splitting up oil revenues and things like that. Silly me, I thought we were trying to establish Iraq as a sovereign nation where they can make those decisions for themselves. I don't really think it's any of America's business to deal with that.
I thought we were there to look for weapons of mass destruction, but I guess I'm just out of it.
And we did.
Yeah, right. It was called Cheney and Rumsfeld.
800-642-1234 is the number you can use if you'd like to join in. Let's move on to what's happening here in the state of Wisconsin. This is some AP copy from a day or so ago, but it still holds up. The candidates for state Supreme Court are trading accusations of potential misconduct as their campaigns gear up for the April 3rd election. Washington County Circuit Judge Annette Ziegler faces Madison attorney Linda Clifford in the race for a 10-year term on the high court. And I think it was last week we heard that nobody knew who was on the Supreme Court, and nobody really knew who was running for the Supreme Court. And at the same time, there is a lot of press going on about what is happening with this particular race. And Owen Robinson, let's start with you. What do you think about the way this race is shaping up?
Honestly, it's quite a disappointment because I think both campaigns are focusing on integrity or scandal issues with the other candidate, and I think that both Linda Clifford and Annette Ziegler are honorable, professional people who have a responsibility and a concern for the law and are respectful of the law. I think they're both good people and good attorneys, and in Ziegler's case, a good judge. I would much rather have seen this campaign focus around judicial philosophy. For instance, Clifford in the debate at Marquette the other night was saying how she would like to revisit the Supreme Court ruling regarding school choice with an eye towards overturning that and outlawing school choice. Ziegler sees a much more modest role for judges, where it doesn't seize the role of a judge to again be very modest and not to supplant the authority of the legislature or the executive branch, but that really hasn't come out. And I would really much rather have seen this race focus around judicial philosophy and how they would act in the future on the court, rather than bickering with these little bitty nothing, stories. Well, that for two honorable candidates.
I'm sure you would rather have it on any issue other than the fact that the judge sat on cases where she had a conflict of interest, and instead of following the black line Supreme Court rule, said that she does a gut check, which means she recognizes the conflict, then asks herself whether she can be fair, and concludes that, yes, indeed, she can be fair. We have rules to be followed, and someone who is running for the Supreme Court ought to follow those rules religiously. So I think it has been quite remarkable. What's also remarkable is that the Bar Association and the Judicial Commission are doing nothing about these issues. And I think the public does expect the profession to vet these candidates or at least find out what's happened. So when Mike McCabe of the Democracy Campaign filed a complaint with the Judicial Commission, they said they'd look into it, but after the election. So I think it really is quite remarkable. And for Judge Ziegler to say that it didn't matter that her husband's bank was a party, or that she had stock of over $50,000 in cases in which she sat as the judge, for a lawyer, that's just astounding. So I think it is just a remarkable development.
Let's go to a caller right now. Jay joins us from Wausau. Hi, Jay.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Professor Garvey, I was a student of yours a couple years back.
I hope you got a good grade.
Well, I did all right.
All right,
and,
good.
I have to say, what you and other professors at the University of Wisconsin taught me about, ethical concerns does lead me to really wonder about Ziegler's actions here. I'm just amazed that she could do this for so long on the bench and it never come up before this, before she runs for a higher office. I'm just curious, the fellow from Boots and Sabres called this, petty minor issues, I believe. And as you rightly pointed out, I mean, we have violations of black letter ethics rules. And my first exposure to this case was a story in our local Wausau City pages where they indicated that she had lied on her application to Tommy Thompson, saying that she was a member of the Republican Party when she wasn't, in fact. It just seems like with all of this up in the air, how can we say that concerns about her judgment is a minor issue in a race for a Supreme Court judge.
And let's give Owen Robinson a chance to respond.
Well, there's a couple things to that. First of all, it hasn't come up to this point because it is a nothing issue. And there was a story in the local West Bend Daily News here, with every single Washington County judge supporting Ziegler, saying she has been an honorable, ethical judge. So by the normal practices of judicial conduct, she acted within them. Now, can we go back and look in the past and say, well, now that she's running for Supreme Court, she should recuse herself from that or this, that, or the other thing? Certainly. But the truth is that she did not, her family did not financially gain from any single ruling she made.
You don't know that.
She, you want to bet?
No, you don't. How do you know
but
that?
But we can go back and pick them apart. But, you know, based on the information at the time, she acted appropriately. And as far as the member of the GOP thing, I'll speak to that just because it's a common complaint, is that there's a lot of people who think they belong to members of, you know, think they're members of organizations. The NRA is a perfect example where you sent in a check 1 year and you think you're a member now, but it's a yearly renewal. So
oh,
the fact
goodness.
That she
I
sent
thought
in
I was still
money
a
to the party and thought she was a member and wasn't. Actually, my as a former membership chair of the Washington County Republican Party Executive Committee, I can tell you this is an extremely common problem of people calling in saying, I thought I was already a member, and reminding them that they do need to send in yearly dues to maintain their membership. So,
well, I just I go back to this. If you have something like 60 cases where either the bank in which your husband served on the board of directors, a bank where you borrowed $3 million from as a judge and a spouse, and you have stocks involved in companies that are in front of you, the judges that I know would never let this slip by. I mean, it's one or two, you'd say, okay, 50 or 60 cases, you got to say there's a real problem here. And the judges that I've appeared before are very careful to make sure that the parties know that if they have any connection whatsoever to any of the parties so that a party can object. She never did that, which is part
well,
of the problem.
That's just it. Many of these cases were default judgments.
Well, many.
That never actually met in front of her. How, you know, these are default judgments for
judges,
you know,
don't have to see the parties.
And small claims judgments because of defaulted loans and stuff. These are not things that require a whole heck of a lot of judicial thought. They're default judgments. So,
well, the rule should
I
then
think
say
it's interesting that we don't look at Clifford, who her husband was the chairman of the State Trial Lawyers Association. There are rulings that Clifford could make on the court that could net
her family. Oh, so she has a potential future problem.
Millions of dollars. And yet nobody talks about that.
Or that you talk about it.
Well, I am right now, but it certainly hasn't made the
Judge Ziegler talks about it
very much. And you know, and it's, yeah, again, this is where I would much rather look forward as to how these two judicial candidates are going to operate on the Supreme Court and how what their judicial philosophy is, rather than going back and nitpicking, you know, $10 you know, default judgment cases from 10 years ago.
Well, if I were you, I would want to look forward, too, because looking backward is pretty disturbing.
And we'll be looking forward to April 3rd, and we'll see how that all turns out. Elsewhere in the state of Wisconsin, the Dennis Troha situation seems to keep it's got a kind of a life of its own. We heard about contributions to the Doyle campaign a couple of weeks ago. We hear about donations now to the Bush campaign. As part of the presidential race last year, and now we are there, and people are trying to draw connections all over the place. Last week, DOT Secretary Frank Buzalaki was confirmed by the legislature, but after some pretty relatively tough questions, he's still confirmed though. And this week, he lost his calendar, and then it reappeared again. And this is the story that doesn't seem to be going away. And let's start with Ed Garvey on this.
Well, it's another example of why we need publicly financed campaigns, and I think it's ridiculous that Jim Doyle hasn't taken the lead in this area, because you can't answer all of these questions. I mean, Trojans gave something like $200,000 to Doyle, paid for the inaugural parties, and Doyle says, well, he wasn't my advisor. Well, for heaven's sakes, I can tell you this, that if somebody gave you $200,000, you listen to them when they give you a call or come in to see you. So I don't think this has been handled well. And I think that the Senate made a mistake by confirming Buzalaki until they got to the bottom of it. Now the FBI will continue its investigation. And it's interesting because Paul Ryan gets into this act as well because of federal legislation. And Jim Oberstar, a Democrat from Minnesota, who came to Milwaukee for a fundraiser, and he got a lot of money. Bush got a lot of money. It shows you that people like Troja don't just give money because they believe in stem cell research or the judicial philosophy of the governor. They give it because they want something. Nobody gives $200,000 to anybody unless they think they're going to get something for it.
Owen Robinson.
Well, I am sitting here in absolute disbelief. I'm stunned. I'm flabbergasted that I agree with Ed Garvey.
I'll give another $100 to public radio.
That I, too, think it's ridiculous that Doyle, you know, that people give $200,000 to a candidate for Doyle to claim that he, you know, that donor has no influence over him is just patently absurd. And, you know, I disagree with Ed in that I don't think I guess I agree with Ed that it's ridiculous that Doyle hasn't taken the lead on campaign finance reform. I don't think it's surprising in that, you know, obviously Doyle has made it a common practice to shake down donors for money and then rule in their favor. So it seems to be a pattern of behavior with him. So I don't find it surprising whatsoever.
Well, the problem,
I think I would disagree with Ed regarding the remedy for this situation, but that's perhaps a more lengthy discussion for another time.
I've said on this program before that if you put Mother Teresa into this political system where you have to raise $15 million to run for governor, she would start doing the same things. You've got to change the culture and the system. Unfortunately, the Madison City Council, I think, has taken a major step toward public financing of local campaigns. Maybe they'll light the fire that will change the way we do business in the state of Wisconsin.
Was that that's not the council where Joe Winicky is supporting a Republican because he got a bunch of money from AT&T, is it?
You know more than I do. I don't know.
I have no idea. We've only got about a minute left, and I want to give each of you about 30 seconds or so maybe to comment on a story that we haven't covered that you think deserves a little more attention. And Owen Robinson, let's start with you.
Wow, boy, there's one out of the gate that I wasn't expecting.
I like to try to stump people occasionally.
A story that I don't think has been covered enough. I think that the crime issue, honestly, in Milwaukee, I think we see here just this week we had a guy from Waukesha came and was filling up gas on 44th and Capitol who was murdered filling up gas. And, you know, at daylight, 3 o'clock in the afternoon crime. I think we have a very serious crisis of crime in Milwaukee that is dragging down both Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, the region, and the state. And I think it's just absolutely deplorable that kind of action is getting no attention from the governor, from the mayor.
And I have to give Ed Garvey his chance to do a story here too quick.
I think it's the tragedy of the Milwaukee Public Museum that ran very well with civil servants through depressions and wars and all the rest of it for 115 years. And then it was privatized because the so-called friends of the museum said that people would be more likely to give money to a privately run museum. They're now looking at bankruptcy, according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel this morning. And, you know, this idea of privatization is always better is just nonsense. And I think every time we look at it, we get a better view of Halliburton and the privatization of the Milwaukee Museum.
Ed Garvey and Owen Robinson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Gene.
Thank you, Ed.
Ed Garvey, senior partner, editor, and publisher of FightingBob.com, and Owen Robinson, a conservative blogger with BootsandSabers.com and the West Bend Daily News. We've been talking about the Week in Review. And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Joy Cardine here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joy will be back on Monday.